It's Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret, here with us on the Ideas Network. We are right in the thick of spooky season this time of year, but for some people, the fascination with ghosts and spirits isn't limited to Halloween. Paranormal investigators search for evidence of the supernatural year-round, and it's become a popular genre on television, with shows like Ghost Hunters now on Travel Channel and Discovery Plus.
On this episode of Ghost Hunters,
there's something standing right there.
The Rialto Theater here in Joliet, Illinois.
They seem to see a little boy. Kevin?
This is a boy who was hit by a vehicle in front of the property.
Do you see anything moving around us?
The crew member came up and was moving his stuff around.
I had my skirt pulled walking down aisle 5 back there.
Is your name Kevin?
Kevin?
We're looking for you.
I just saw something walk.
There's something big out there.
This place is crazy.
Whether you believe in ghosts or not, our search for evidence of the haunted reveals something about ourselves and about our culture. Our next guest embedded himself in the paranormal investigator community to learn more about what ghost hunters actually do and why they do it. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you watch any of the Ghost Hunter shows? What do you think of them? And why do you think people are so fascinated by the things we cannot see? And if you could talk to a ghost or spirit, would you want to? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mark Eaton is an associate professor of sociology and the chair of the sociology and anthropology department at Ripon College. He's the author of the book Sensing Spirits, Paranormal Investigation, and the Social Construction of Ghosts. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about paranormal investigators or ghost hunters, what specifically does that entail? How would you describe what they do?
The general principle is that they are searching for evidence of the existence of spirits and or an effort to communicate with those spirits. So that's typically done through technologies of various sorts, like the ones that are often featured on those shows that you just mentioned, ghost hunters and things of that nature. Or for people who believe that they have the ability to contact spirits through extrasensory means, oftentimes it's as simple as just sitting in a dark room and trying to open up for communication. So there's a variety of different ways that people do it, but those are the two main styles, I guess I would say.
Well, you're a sociology professor, so how did you get involved in researching ghost hunters?
Actually, through those shows. As a graduate student, I needed a diversion from what I was doing at the time, and watching ghost hunting shows was pretty exciting. So I initially watched them for entertainment, but then, of course, started to think about them from a sociological perspective and thought it was fascinating to wonder why people search for evidence of ghosts, how they went about doing that, how they made sense of what they experienced during those investigations in terms of knocks on the floor or a feeling of their hair being tugged or things of that nature. And then ultimately, kind of the bigger questions that we have in terms of what happens after we die, and is there a possibility of some form of life beyond physical death? And for all of those reasons, I found it just increasingly fascinated and decided to go ahead and study it by actually just investigating with the investigators.
What are some of the common characteristics or themes that you saw with the investigators you spent time with? I guess, did you get a sense of the motivation behind their work? I would imagine it varies from person to person.
Yeah, it does vary from person to person, but there are trends as well. Most commonly, the people who I investigated with and interviewed had some kind of experience, oftentimes in their childhood, where they believed that they had been in the presence of a spirit. Not all of those people identified as sensitives, but were simply people who were certain that they had had an experience in their childhood or perhaps in their, you know, young adulthood or even later in life that they couldn't explain through ordinary means. And so that unanswered question was a motivation for a lot of people. For other people, it wasn't necessarily that they had personally had an experience, but they had been raised in a family where believing in ghosts or telling stories about ghosts or telling stories about places in their community that were allegedly haunted was part of their upbringing, and it became a fascination that they wanted to investigate. In some cases, people got motivated by the loss of a loved one. and they found themselves trying to find some sort of proof that that person wasn't completely gone or that they could communicate with them. So those are kind of, I guess, the sort of beginning motivations. As people got involved, their motivations changed as to why they actually continued. But in terms of why they got involved in the first place, that kind of is the majority of the cases.
We're talking with Ripon College sociology professor Mark Eaton about his research into paranormal investigators and why they investigate ghosts. Do you have an interest in the paranormal? There's time for your story, too. Join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of the methods that ghost hunters use to investigate the paranormal? What stands out to you about their methods and how they conduct these investigations?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question because I think it has been informed to a large degree by the TV shows. The most dominant way people go about investigating, at least the people that I interviewed and investigated with, which seemed to be representative of the subculture as a whole, was sort of technology heavy and a kind of science oriented approach to investigating. So sometimes thousands of dollars worth of equipment being brought into these locations that are alleged to have had spirit activity, things from, you know, electromagnetic frequency readers to cameras with night vision, motion detectors, vibration detectors, barometric pressure sensors, you name it. So that tends to be the most dominant way of investigating. And with that comes also a sort of mindset of skepticism or a desire to make an effort to debunk as many claims as possible, which is oftentimes sort of surprising to people who don't know a lot about the subculture, that there's an emphasis on disproving many reports of ghostly activity through finding natural explanations for it, things like black mold or high electromagnetic frequency coming off of various electronics in a home. And attempting to essentially separate the wheat from the chaff until you're left with things that you can't explain through natural means. So that's the primary kind of dominant way of investigating. But there is a secondary trend within the subculture, which is people who believe that they have various ways of engaging with spirits through extrasensory means, whether it's hearing them or seeing them or feeling their presence or sensing their emotions, or in some cases, feeling as though the spirits can actually sort of occupy their bodies for a period of time. And in those cases, people aren't so much going in looking for evidence of ghosts because they feel as though they already know that kind of intrinsically through their bodies and through their minds, but rather they're looking to establish a connection with those spirits, trying to see what they want, see if they can help them cross over. So their methods differ quite a bit from the people who are technology heavy, and they tend to not come in with the skeptic mindset so much.
I'm curious about the TV shows that you mentioned. How accurate is what we see on TV? When we're watching Ghost Hunters or other programs, we see these practices that the investigator practices. How does that compare to real life investigations who do it without cameras recording everything for broadcast, things that you've seen yourself?
Yeah, there's an interesting sort of relationship between the TV shows and the actual investigation teams, because many of the people that I interviewed and investigated with were inspired by the TV shows initially to get involved in this practice, maybe to create their own team or to Google and find out that there was a team in their area that they could join. So the TV shows are similar to the forms of investigation that I participated in and observed. In part, I think, because the TV shows were the inspiration for kind of how to investigate correctly to some degree. So the technologies and the efforts to find rational explanations and some of the sensory or rather sensitive practices, those are similar in some ways to what you see on TV. One thing I would say is a big taboo within the subculture that's represented a lot by shows like Ghost Adventures, for example, is the provoking strategy, the effort to attempt to get spirits to harm someone or attempt to anger spirits to get them to act out in ways that, you know, you can capture on audio or video or capture on your own body through scratches or getting pushed down or whatever. Some people in paranormal investigation teams do that thing or do those things, but by and large, what I found is that that effort is seen as disrespectful to spirits. Many people I talked to said, you know, if this was your grandma who was haunting this home, you wouldn't want somebody coming in and yelling those things at her. So why would we go in and do that? So the provoking and the kind of outlandish behavior and the thrill-seeking behavior that happens on some of the TV shows is really more taboo within the subculture. But the technologies and the kind of mediumistic efforts to communicate with spirits are present in the subculture.
So interesting, Mark. We're talking to Ripon College sociology professor Mark Eaton about his research into paranormal investigations and why we seek evidence of the supernatural. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you could talk to the dead, would you? And who would you want to talk to? What questions would you have? And what questions do you have about this, about paranormal investigators and the fascination with ghosts and spirits? Call us, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Mark Eaton. He is a sociology professor at Ripon College, and he's with us today to share his research into the world of paranormal investigators and why people are on the hunt for the evidence of ghosts and spirits. We'd like to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of ghost hunters and the shows about them? What questions do you have for our guest about why and how people investigate the paranormal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mark, I'd imagine that you're often asked whether you believe in ghosts. It's got to be a common question for you. But I'd say the concept is a little more complicated than that. And your book title has an interesting phrase, social construction of ghosts. Can you explain what that means exactly?
Yeah. So my kind of angle on the topic is that I'm neither attempting to prove the existence of ghosts or definitively debunk the existence of ghosts, or in any way attempt to deride or demean people who do believe in ghosts. As a sociologist, I'm kind of trying to stand on the margins, I guess you could say, of paranormal investigation and examine it, you know, as objectively as you can, I guess, as a human and as a participant in it, a participant observer in it, I should say, as a researcher. So, you know, the idea of social construction is that things may not have an objective reality to them, or they might have an objective reality to them, but it's how we as individuals and we as groups engage with the idea of something that can make it real in its consequences for people. So the idea of social construction of ghosts, I guess, is multifaceted, but one aspect of it is that the ghosts that are believed to inhabit certain spaces are kind of made real, regardless of whether you believe that they objectively are present in the sites or you completely, you know, don't believe in the notion of spirits at all. People who do go in and investigate for ghosts kind of engage in processes that make those spirits real, at least in the moment, through asking for proof of their existence, by calling out by name people who they believe are haunting these sites, and attempting to engage with them essentially as people without bodies, as some of the people that I interviewed referred to them as. And so ghosts are real in a social constructionist sense, whether or not they're objectively real in some sort of, you know, larger sense. And then the social construction of ghosts also gets back to some of the kind of cultural ways that we engage with ghosts, like especially around this time of year, ghost stories, TV shows, the paranormal investigation shows that you've mentioned already in the show. All of those kind of maintain our fascination with the idea of ghosts, and to some degree add some credibility to the possibility, at least, that ghosts exist. And so the concept of ghosts is, I guess, what I'm engaging with in my research is how do we believe in ghosts and how do we put those beliefs into action, both as individuals and in these paranormal investigation teams?
We have a caller. Mark is with us from Bloomer. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
Okay. I was a total skeptic. I not one who is on the fringe at all. I'm a pretty level-headed guy. My wife and I are sitting in the living room, and the only light in the house that was on was a lamp across the way. We were watching TV. Snap. You hear the lamp turn off. But 3 seconds later, snap. You hear, see the lamp turn back on. Power didn't go out because the lights in the TV stayed on. I can't explain it. We hear footsteps up in the room next door to us. It's her and me and our baby at the time, and he didn't walk. We were in bed. I don't get it. Is this like normal? Does this stuff like happen and people just don't recognize it or what?
I don't know. What do you have about what Mark said about this? I mean, somebody who's a skeptic and then they hear all this stuff. How do you explain all of that?
Yeah, and that certainly resonates with a lot of the people I spoke to who got involved in paranormal investigation was that they were skeptics. Some of them were born and raised as believers, but a lot of people weren't until they had some experience that they couldn't explain, sort of like the caller Mark mentioned, you know, sitting in their house and they hear footsteps or doors opening and shutting or lights going on and off, or even things more dramatic than that, waking up to see some, you know, red-eyed entity sleeping next to them or something. I heard some pretty wild stories in my interviews. And so, you know, the short answer is I don't have an explanation for those things. I also, I respect the people who claim to have had those experiences, because in most cases, there's no effort to monetize that or to make a name for yourself on the basis of that. Because, you know, the reality is that although statistically a majority of Americans on various surveys report that they do believe spirits can haunt homes or that you can communicate with the dead, it's still very much a stigmatized belief in our society, right? People who, adults at least, who say that they believe in ghosts oftentimes are sort of laughed at, or they're considered gullible, or people try to tell them why they're wrong. So, you know, it's not until you have someone come along and say, you know, I don't think you're crazy, that someone will open up about the types of experiences like the caller had. So, you know, as I said, the short answer for that particular event is I don't know what caused that. I can't say definitively, but it certainly resonates with a lot of the reasons why people got involved in paranormal investigation in the first place.
We have time for another call. I'd like to take Kathy in Hales Corners. Kathy, thanks for calling in.
Well, thank you.
What kind of...
My comment is I absolutely would love to talk to a ghost. I think that would be a wonderful experience. I would not be fearful at all. And the reason I think that most people are interested in ghosts is because we're all searching for the answer to what happens after we die. Mm-hmm. And if we can talk to a ghost and it's a verifiable thing, we would know.
Sure. Kathy, thanks for that. And Mark, is that kind of what you hear from people? I mean, you make the case that this is a deeper and more meaningful process than, you know, than perhaps even what you see on TV. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think that it is a more meaningful process for a lot of people. You know, the TV shows tend to understandably make it look like a sort of thrill show. But for the people that do it, a lot of them get a kind of deep spiritual meaning from it. So there's a variety of kind of religiosities among paranormal investigators, but most of them are in some way, shape, or form religious. Some are deeply religious. Some were raised in a tradition and kind of drifted away from it. And for some, actually, the investigation itself brings them back to some sort of spirituality that they were largely distant from by the time they started investigating. And kind of getting to the caller's point, you know, several of the people that I interviewed and investigated with said something along the lines of, you know, when I went to church, I had to have faith, but when I do this, I get to have proof. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really powerful, you know, that people are searching for that answer to the question. And sometimes some people are satisfied with answers that are rooted in faith, but a lot of people are looking for something that they feel is more tangible than that. And paranormal investigation provides people one avenue by which they feel like they can might they might be able to make direct contact with something that proves to them that there's some form of consciousness, there's some form of personality, a person basically that exists beyond physical death. And if that exists for the person who's haunting this property, then it could possibly exist for you or for your loved ones, right? So there's a lot to be said for the spiritual significance of paranormal investigation, certainly.
We have about a minute left in our time together, and I wanted to touch on something that you write about in your book. You say that paranormal investigation is really marginalized by the mainstream scientific and religious communities. What effect does that have on the people participating in ghost hunting? Is it daunting for them?
I think it is. I think it's a challenge that in some ways they also embrace. You know, many people that I spoke to perceive paranormal investigation as a kind of pioneering scientific effort, right? That maybe right now it's marginalized, and maybe right now they haven't found the kind of smoking gun, irrefutable proof of the existence of ghosts. But they're confident that with the latest technologies and what might be coming down the road in 5, 10, 15 years, that they might be able to finally be the people who definitively prove that there's some form of life or some form of consciousness that exists beyond death. Sure. And to the extent that happens, they continue to be motivated by that desire to advance science rather than simply be rejected by it.
Mark, I want to thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you as well.
Mark Eaton is an associate professor of sociology and the chair of the sociology and anthropology department at Ripon College, with us today discussing paranormal investigations and his book, Sensing Spirits, Paranormal Investigation, and the Social Construction of Ghosts. I'm Shereen Seward, and for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Rob Ferret. Now, in 2022, Wisconsin saw a record-setting increase in domestic violence-related suicides and homicides, with an increase of 20% compared to the previous year. That's according to a report from End Domestic Abuse Wisconsin. We'll talk with a domestic violence and policy researcher about why Wisconsin's problem with domestic violence is getting worse and what we can do to improve. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work with victims of domestic violence? Do you know how to spot the signs? Do you know of any local or national resources for victims? If you have some words of support for people experiencing domestic violence, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Marielle Barnes is an assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Marielle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
When we talk about domestic violence-related deaths, what does that include?
So it captures a number of different things. So it will capture death that occurred between victims and perpetrators who were partners or spouses or former partners or spouses. It also captures adults who had children in common and there was a domestic violence situation there. Sometimes it will also capture a child's death that's happened in the context of a domestic violence situation, or even death that's occurred between an adult child and a parent or a grandparent.
So it's a range of deaths that we're talking about. Why do you think that domestic violence-related deaths spiked last year? What played into that?
Mm-hmm. I think there's a number of different factors that have played into this. So the first one is the prevalence of firearms, most definitely. So firearms were the most common weapon used in these domestic violence homicides. Almost 90% of these deaths involved a firearm. And so that definitely exacerbates things. The other big reason that this is happening, I think, is because there's decreasing support for victims of violence, and sexual violence. A lot of Wisconsin organizations are facing significant cuts, to the point where when I'm talking to different domestic violence organizations, they're saying that they're going to have to close their shelters, or they can't afford to like have their hotlines open 24/7, which is really important. And then the third reason I would say is that there's really a shortage of affordable housing right now in Wisconsin, and that makes it very difficult for victims of violence to leave situations and find somewhere to live away from that violence and away from that abuse.
You mentioned the funding piece, and I'm curious about that, Mario. Is that a local, a county, a state, or a federal funding issue? Is it a combination of factors? Where is the money going, going away?
Yeah. So, a lot of the funding is A lot of organizations get funding from what we call VOCA, which is the violence legislation. And so that is actually decreasing 70%. So Wisconsin will see a 70% cut in federal funding to domestic violence and sexual assault services. This year, or this coming year, they're anticipating getting $13.5 million in funding, but last year it was 44.5. So that's a significant cut. And that's a lot of organizations fund a lot of services from that money.
I have to say that among other U.S. states, Wisconsin sits in the middle of the rankings for rates of domestic violence. So why is our death rate so high?
Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's the prevalence of firearms, and it's the affordable housing issue. That's a huge problem. To put this in perspective, in the same period last year, Minnesota only had 24 people die as a result of domestic violence. And I would say that those two states are fairly comparable, right? We're mm-hmm. both Midwestern states, both Northern, but Wisconsin is much, much worse.
Well, let's delve into that a little bit. Are there any restrictions in Wisconsin on gun ownership for people convicted of a domestic violence related crime right now?
I'm not 100% on that. There is a case going up to the Supreme Court right now about whether people who have been convicted of domestic violence can own a firearm. I can tell you that research shows that domestic violence homicides decrease 7% in states that actually do pass laws that confiscate firearms from individuals who have a restraining order. But that's not in Wisconsin, as far as I am aware.
Mario Barnes is with us today to discuss the increase in domestic violence-related deaths in Wisconsin, and there's plenty of time for your calls and thoughts on this difficult issue. 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Carry, which is a Second Amendment rights advocacy group, suggested that the state should allow people who are awarded a restraining order to be able to get that temporary concealed carry permit. Do you think that would mitigate the number of domestic violence-related deaths in the state? What impact would that have?
I don't think it would mitigate it. I think it would make it more prevalent. The risk of death goes up 5 times when a firearm is in the household. It's just so much easier when people are angry and when emotions are high to commit an action that you would not without having that firearm present. So I think having the firearm in the household and having concealed carry laws would increase deaths related to domestic violence.
You think it would have the opposite effect from
yes.
from what they intend? Mm-hmm. You also talked about affordable housing, and boy, this is in the headlines all over the place. No matter what community you're mm-hmm. in, you hear about the housing affordability crisis, not enough housing, not enough affordable housing. Talk a little bit about the connection there. What's the connection between affordable housing and domestic violence deaths?
Mm-hmm. So when you're in a situation of domestic violence, obviously you need somewhere to go. And usually that can be a domestic violence shelter. It can be family or friends. It can be like alternative people that you know, but ultimately, like, you cannot leave that situation unless you have a permanent place to live and a safe place to live. And what we're seeing is that rents are extremely high right now. Interest rates are very, very high, and it makes it hard to buy a home. And there's just a lack of affordable housing stock. So if you have no long-term solution about where you're going to stay, like, you might not leave the situation that you're currently in because you just don't know where you're going to live. Or you don't know where your kids are, you know, you can put a roof over your kid's head and where they're going to go to school and that kind of thing. And this is occurring in both rural areas that have a shortage of housing stock, but it's also in urban areas. So in Madison and Milwaukee that really need extra or need more housing in general. And also it's affordable, but also quality housing, right? So it's houses that are safe and secure for people to live in, essentially.
Well, we've talked about affordable housing, and we've talked about the funding gap, and we've talked about gun policy. Aside from those things, and I know that's a lot, but what can be done to reduce the number of domestic violence-related deaths in Wisconsin? What other solutions might be out there that you and other advocates and advocates are looking at as potential game changers?
Mm-hmm. So obviously controlling firearms or restricting firearms to people who are responsible with them and don't have domestic violence convictions, mm-hmm. More affordable housing, but also, I guess, raising awareness is really, really important. So a lot of people who are experiencing domestic abuse and domestic violence often don't realize that they're experiencing that. We often think of domestic violence as physical or sexual violence against people, but there's a whole range of other things that it can include. So it can include financial abuse, right? So maybe your partner is opening up credit cards in your name and running up debt. So you can't, you don't have a good credit score. And when people do a credit background check on you, you can't get a house, right? Mm-hmm. Or your landlord doesn't want to rent to you. Or maybe they are controlling how much money you have every week. It's also people being, you know, domestic violence also includes like stalking. So I have talked to victims who have said that their partners send them flowers as an apology, and people say, oh, that's very nice of them. But what the victims actually want is no contact at all. And so realizing that all of these different forms of violence exist, and realizing when you are in a relationship like that and recognizing those kind of red flags are really, really important, I think, for getting people out of those relationships.
I've heard from survivors of domestic violence that getting a restraining order is kind of an arduous process. I was a little surprised by that, what they have to go through to get a restraining order. Sometimes there's, you know, costs involved. Is that something, is that process something that could be streamlined? Would that help? And do restraining orders help at all?
Mm-hmm. I definitely think the process is more onerous than it has to be. It is improving, particularly as awareness through the judiciary of domestic violence and what domestic violence includes improves. I definitely think we could do more, though, to make that an easier process. In terms of whether restraining orders help, the results are mixed on that. If an abuser is very, very motivated, it can be very difficult to dissuade them, is what I will say. But also, a restraining order or an order of protection means they cannot approach you. So there is, if your abuser does approach you, there are legal recourses to breaking that order.
We're talking with Marielle Barnes, assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, about why domestic violence-related deaths are becoming more frequent in Wisconsin. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share, have you or someone you know escaped a domestic violence situation? What helped you leave? And what kind of support systems were there for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Mario Barnes, assistant professor at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We are talking about the spike in domestic violence-related deaths we've seen in Wisconsin over the last year and what we can do to prevent them. We want to hear what you think. 800-642-1234. Do you have ideas for protections you think that would help for survivors of domestic abuse? What restrictions do you think we should place on perpetrators? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Mario, what are some of the signs of a potentially abusive partner that people should be watching for?
Mm-hmm. There's a number of different signs that you can think about. So the first one is obviously any kind of threat that someone would make against you. So if someone says like they're going to kill you, you should take that very seriously. Another sign is if you've ever been strangled by a partner before. We know that the odds of a homicide or dying at the hands of a partner increase sevenfold if you've previously been strangled. And oftentimes when that happens, the consequences of having someone's hands around your throat, which is a particularly sensitive area, don't emerge potentially for days. And so that's something when I hear someone has been strangled, I'm always very concerned about them. And I always recommend that they go to see a doctor to be checked out and let the doctor know what is going on, because they can refer you to services. Other things, so oftentimes abusers will love bomb people, is what we call it.
What does that mean? Love bomb. I don't think I've heard that before.
Mm-hmm. That means where they're very attentive to you. They will provide, you know, they will give you presents. They will be on their best behavior. And then that's often that often goes on for a period of days or a couple of weeks. And then all of a sudden, you know, they will be violent or abusive or harassing you. And then all of a sudden, once they realize what they've done, they're very apologetic. They go back to being a very loving and caring kind of partner. But that loving and caringness does not outweigh the violence and abusive that they commit against people. So that would be something, if you think they're in this kind of cycle of like abuse and violence and then love, like those two things are not balancing each other out, mm-hmm. that can potentially be an abusive relationship as well.
We have Michelle with us now from Mequon. Michelle, hi.
Hi. So my 10 years since, or should I say saga, was I used to go to group and it was a little bit too quiet when I told my story, so I kind of felt ashamed. I was in a 10-year relationship that at the very end, before we went to court in like 2016, he tried to strangle me, and I had a list of things for the restraining order, and we went to court and he openly admitted in court that he tried to strangle me, but I could not use it against him because that was 2016 ago, as it reads in the transcript. I feel there should be some kind of tougher laws, because I was blatantly told that basically, even though he said that under oath, I would not be able to probably make anything stick. Mm-hmm. And I kind of gave up on the idea of making it stick, but the judge did offer me, in all fairness, a 10-year restraining order. He said, would you like a 4 or a 10-year restraining order?
So you got the restraining order, but you feel like there just weren't any real punishments for your partner then?
I mean, I feel like he's suffering because he hit a social worker, so then he wasn't able to see his kids either.
Okay. Michelle, thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate the call. What do you think about that, Marielle? I mean, do punishments need to be stronger? Would that help?
Potentially. So one of the things I often hear from victims is, you know, I wish my partner, I knew where my partner was. And I've had a number of different victims say, like, if they're in jail, I know where they are and that makes me feel safe. But on the other hand, we have to also think about kind of the carceral justice system and how that works. And so it's really difficult to balance like different concerns here. I do hear a lot from victims that they often don't feel believed by the justice system as well. And they feel like they feel shame and they feel like they go through that process and then nothing comes of it. And so that we can definitely improve that, I think, a lot.
We have Maddie with us now. Maddie is calling from South Central Wisconsin. Maddie, thanks for calling.
Hi. So I just wanted to speak to some of the frustrations I've had myself within this process in Madison. So when you file a restraint, and I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last person, so I'm not sure if I'm repeating anything, but when you file a restraining order, you actually have to go to court with the person. I mean, they said typically they don't show up.
Oh, yeah. And you have to face them right there. Mm-hmm.
Yes. This person I thought would show up, which was scary, but I was willing to still do it. So I said, make sure you call me because I'm in the process of moving and et cetera. They assured me they would call me about the court date. And then instead they emailed me like 36 hours ahead of time.
Okay.
And so I missed it. And then you have to start all back over. And it really is, it's like a horribly traumatic experience because you have to rewrite everything that happened, why you're actually, like, it's just, it's a lot of stress and it is a lot of strings to pull to even make it happen in the first place. And I just don't understand why you have to argue against somebody else in court. And they were like, and then you might be up for defamation.
Okay. You know, and Maddie, thank you so much for calling. Marielle, when we hear Maddie talk about her experience and that frustration, is that something that's very common, that that knowing that you have to go to court and face the person who is your abuser, how deterring is that for victims?
That's very deterring. And that's super common that we hear, in that the burden is placed on the victim to prove that they have been a victim of domestic violence. And it's, they have to jump through hoops all the time. And as Maddie was saying, like, you know, if you miss a step or you miss a date, you have to restart the whole process again, which is a problem. And facing your abuser is not an easy task. I've heard stories of like abusers like tapping a lighter on the table and like you would fiddle with a pen kind of thing. And it seems like a very innocuous gesture until you find out that that particular abuser had threatened to douse their partner in gasoline and light them on fire. And so facing your abuser, even in a court, is very, very intimidating. And we do not make it easy for people to do that and to seek recourse and to seek protect orders of protection and things like that.
In our final 30, 45 seconds, how might listeners get involved in helping survivors of domestic abuse?
Mm-hmm. So there's always organizations throughout Wisconsin that are providing support, domestic violence organizations. Many of them ask for volunteers to help out. A lot of them have regular fundraising efforts to provide help to survivors so they can provide so they can keep the hotline open, the shelter open, so they can help survivors get into housing or buy a car or pay for moving expenses. So I would definitely encourage people to look at their local organizations and reach.
Mario, thank you so much for joining us today. Assistant Professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Appreciate you being with us. Throughout the U.S., national holidays are important, each one with its own significance and customs, but there are quite a few lesser-known national days that are celebrated throughout the year that you might find surprising. At least I did when I stumbled upon a National What Day website. Today, for example, is International Artists Day. It is Lung Health Day, National Cartoonists Against Crime Day. It's National Greasy Foods Day, yay! Punk for a Day Day, World Pizza Makers Day, and I Care About You Day. I have no idea who came up with these wacky holidays, but there you have it. It might sound silly, but marketing schemes aside, in a world where the headlines are so often filled with painful stories, appreciating the small things that make life meaningful is good enough for me. This is Central Time.